Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, so just a quick reminder, the rest of this month, our book of the month is Suicide Squad Trial by Fire? I think that's what
yeah,
it's called?
I think that's it.
Which is still 15% off. The Reading with Rogues has passed. We had a good time talking about Suicide Squad
and
Watchmen.
That was a ton of fun.
And we'll have our selections coming up for September, October. But for the rest of August, Suicide Squad Trial by Fire is 15% off, 25% off if you have a Rogue card. Then Gaming with Rogues is this weekend. That's August 20th. They're playing Pandemic, the co-op game of disease fighting, which is super awesome. And then on August 24th, that Wednesday, from 12:30 to 1:30, we'll have Cully Hamner here signing the variant cover for Blue Beetle Rebirth number one, which I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah.
And then coming up September, a couple big things. Of course, we have our Magic the Gathering Kaladesh pre-release on Sunday, September 25th. And September 17th will be Batman Day, which is always kind of a fun day. This year, the notable thing is that they're giving away free copies of Batman number one, the new Rebirth number one with a special cover. But also, Batman and Catwoman are going to be here in costume from like noon to about 3:30. They'll get to come out and take pictures with them. We're going to have a couple artists, Devin Kraft and Jake Eckes, here doing sketches, like quick Batman-related sketches for us. And we're doing 15% off on all Batman-related like merchandise, graphic novels, that stuff that day.
Yep.
So good day to come out.
So if you've been watching like the animated Killing Joke and you need to see where it came from, that's a good day to pick it up. Check out Dark Knight Returns, some of the Scott Snyder's Batman run, all the kinds of good stuff.
All right, on to the news for the week. So they announced, I'm just going to go in order. This is weird to me. Jason Momoa, who's playing Aquaman, is going to be the Crow?
Yeah, I saw that.
Why do people keep going back to the Crow?
You know, people like the Crow.
Do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think people do.
You know what I think it was? It was like their first sort of serious teenage, first blush pass of Grim and Gritty.
Okay.
Do you guys like the first movie?
I have no fondness at all for The Crow.
I think as movies go, the original is good. I think subsequent sort of returns to that storyline.
I
wouldn't go so far as to call it good. I will call it not bad.
That was Alex Proyas.
Yeah,
going to make Dark City and stuff.
Yeah, it's got some solid action moments, but I think that the story of the Crow is not that compelling. I'm just not a fan.
Well, it's a straight up revenge movie.
Yeah,
but you know, in a weird way, it does seem to harken back to a like an 80s trope that my girlfriend was raped and killed, and now it's time for vengeance.
It's even further. It's something like 70s exploitation. It's like Death Wish kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of true.
And I feel it feels so dated and a little gross to me, honestly. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if they're going to try and like reinvent it in such a way that it you know has some different resonance. You know, I know there was like you know a poetic undercurrent too that like literally like there's poems interwoven into it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which sounds like it, I mean, it kind of sounds a little bit like a high school emo kid, you know?
Yeah.
But the weird thing about Momoa is that he is such an obviously intimidating guy.
Yeah.
And the whole deal with the Crow was I think he was like sort of normal guy who became scary after
that. Well, it was Brandon Lee. And that was the other thing I was going to say is that, yeah, the Crow should be like a slim martial artist type guy. The notion of this sort of beefy, bulky dude is a different take on it.
What if they CG him like they did with Hobbit technology, so he's a lanky dude?
What if they CG him so he's a Hobbit? A Hobbit version of the Crow.
You shall not pass. Now, I think that whatever they're going to do with it, I suspect it's kind of something a different bent than the original.
But,
it's going to be the Crow's going to be super
different iterations of the Crow, too. It's not
that's
just
true.
The one guy.
It's sort of like the Phantom, more like, where there's different people who Phantom up.
Yeah. I mean,
the Phantom, if it wasn't interesting.
I don't know. I think the Phantom is the Phantom if the Phantom wasn't interesting.
Oh, that's harsh, but
I
true.
Mean, did you ever read the original graphic novel?
Yeah.
It was based on?
Not my thing. Yeah. The thing is, like, I can definitely see a sort of goth warrior type version of this is interesting. Like, if you Neil Gaiman it up a bit and go into sort of that.
Yeah.
The weirdest thing for me is that Jason Momoa is playing Aquaman in Justice League. Doesn't playing the Crow seem like a step down?
You know, I have a feeling that Momoa is a little bit like
he's like Raul Julia.
Raul Julia. That's what I think of when I think of him. No, but I was going to think of like more the action hero types that he plays. Like, you know how The Rock is just, he'll do anything. Sometimes he ends up
in Tooth Fairy is evidence of that.
Sometimes he ends up in a good movie. Sometimes he ends up in a bad movie. Most of the time he ends up in a bad movie.
That's true.
But, you know, he takes on action roles. I think some of these guys just, you know, Nicolas Cage went from indie movie guy to action movie guy for a while.
So I asked this of you guys. Has Momoa been in any of the Fast and Furious franchise?
No.
Doesn't he seem like a guy that, like, that should be what he's doing?
Yeah.
Adding in the 16th Fast and Furious guy?
He probably likes...
Honestly, I think the big action... I think the big action movie things are a little bit more... in demand for him. I think that's maybe what he wants to do.
Yeah, it just seems crazy to me.
I could see him as... He needs to be like a bad guy with a slight code of honor in the Fast and Furious.
How about the rebooted Ivan Drago's son who fights Creed in Creed 2?
Watch it.
All right. Moving on, we have, again, weird news, but I'm kind of excited about this. Grant Morrison... And Brian Taylor, the guy who did Crank, are developing Brave New World for sci-fi.
Is Brave New World the famous 30s, I believe, sci-fi novel?
Aldous Huxley's, yeah.
Yeah, that was sort of the 1984 of its era.
Yeah.
The proto-1984.
Everyone was sort of drugged into complacency and...
I think it... I want to say... I feel like there might have even been like... xenophobic stuff that was like,
yeah,
like accepted persecution of like racial persecution and lower, yeah, maybe were like a caste system or something.
Yeah.
I haven't read it since high school, but I remember it was pretty compelling at the time.
Oh, I really liked it when I read it in high school. Yeah, and I haven't read it in a while, but yeah, this is an interesting. I'd like to see this. I'm curious to see what they do.
I think it's a good pairing. I mean, the guy who does Crank just does Insanity. Like,
well, it seems weird. I mean, have you ever read it?
I've never read the
because Brave New World is definitely less. It's more cerebral.
It is, although it's that kind of... I mean, it seemed like Philip K. Dick also,
yeah,
before Philip,
yeah,
K. Dick.
But don't you think with Grant Morrison and this guy coming on board, it's going to be a complete overhaul of that?
I do
it's
think
gonna have,
that's true.
It's going to have the sort of same ideas and sort of maybe some the same thoughts, but
yeah,
it's going to be a new
but
package.
At 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah. The guy doing Crank is not the guy I would have put on this, but I'm curious.
I mean, the same guy who... The Crank did Ghost Rider, the second Ghost Rider.
You're not helping, Nick.
Brave New World!
Yeah, that's
Sega!
That's my big worry.
Make Seven Up yours.
Grant Morrison, though, seems like a guy who could do it. He's a guy who thinks these kind of...
He's
know,
also kind of a pop guy, though, too.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I do think it's going to be like Nick's right. It'll be an overhauled version of it.
Yeah, I hope that they don't go into crazy Crank mode. That's my only worry. Flash and Supergirl doing a musical episode.
And who was in the first? Or who was in both Cranks?
It's
Jason
Statham.
Statham.
I remember liking the first one.
I just want can Jason Statham be in Brave New World?
Probably.
Time to clean up this Brave New World.
all right. Flash and Supergirl are doing the musical episode we've all wanted.
Yep.
I'm super excited about this.
I'm excited. I actually saw some cynicism out there like,
oh, yeah,
I guess they're out of ideas or whatever.
Some people hate musicals. I always forget that.
What's wrong with people?
But there are people who hate musicals.
And you know, the other thing is like, I mean, this one has a particular reason to do it because they have like at least several people who are known musical talents.
Well, everybody was. I mean,
Grant Gustin.
They were, yeah, Grant Gustin and...
what's his name was in Rent.
Yeah, well, he was one of the original cast.
The Joe.
Jesse L. Martin.
Yeah.
The girl who plays Supergirl, whose name I'm blanking on for some reason. I remember Kara... Sorrel, but we've all blanked on the name. The two of them were both on Glee. Flash and Supergirl,
I
both on
she
Glee.
Was,
yeah,
as well.
And Melissa Benoist. Yes,
sorry,
that's it.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a ton of people in the CW verse who have done singing and professional and that kind of thing. So
you know,
I'm excited about
not
this.
Not Stephen Amell, though. He can't sing.
No.
I immediately heard like people mentioning like the Music Meister episode,
yeah,
of was it Brave and the Bold?
It was, yeah, Brave,
it was
and the
Brave
Bold.
And the Bold.
But somebody else on my Facebook feed also said something like, I smell Mixia's Piddalake. And I was like, oh, I
oh,
can
that'd
see
be great.
That.
Yeah.
He's just his way to lighten up the world or whatever.
What if they just decide to start singing one day?
You know, that is how musicals work, and I would have zero problem with a musical episode that had no explanation whatsoever.
I think you need an explanation.
I believe there'll be an explanation.
But I think they will probably,
yeah,
do it, yeah.
The Music Meister...
What if Darkseid? Darkseid is the musical villain
no,
from Apocalypse.
No, it would be Desaad.
I think, well, for some people, it's going to be decided.
I missed my grand calling of musical theater.
I think the Music Meister, well, I think he's kind of, I mean, Neil Patrick Harris was great as Music Meister.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a one-note thing, no pun intended. I don't know that I want the Music Meister to be, like, a thing.
What
in
if
the,
it was music, what if Neil Patrick Harris playing the Music Meister?
See, I think that's fine. I'm not as excited about that notion as everybody else is, but... You need an explanation? That's great. That'll work.
Yeah. The weird thing is, in superheroes, there's any number of ways you can do it. You can even have it where they sidestep into an alternate reality that's like a musical reality.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but you can do it for one episode, yeah. And who cares?
Yeah, yep. Buffy got away with it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Buffy straight up had like some kind of curse thing.
Yep. All right. Captain Marvel, they have announced, is going to have a new origin for the movies.
That is Captain Marvel Shazam. No, Captain Marvel Carol Danvers.
Carol Danvers.
Right, and it's precisely because they want to... Well, I mean, I think they didn't... This wasn't public, but she has a messy origin anyway.
There's a messy origin anyway. I'm honestly not 100% sure what it is. I know she got Kree tampered with.
Yep.
And then the Brood tampered with her again.
You know what I know.
But I think... And this is something I hadn't thought about, but I guess people said that it was too close to Green Lantern's origin. Which is weird because, I mean, Green Lantern gets a power ring and joins a Corps, and there's not a Captain Marvel
but
Corps.
But I guess the deal is she's...
Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Is that Chris Yost who did a lot of the work on that?
Oh, you mean the cartoon?
The cartoon, yeah. That actually, yeah. Like, she was an Air Force captain that was, like, knocked unconscious.
Right, I think that's the thing.
Was in a coma for a while, and, like, Captain Mar-Vell, like, Kree sort of tampered with her DNA. Well, see,
I mean, I understand their basic thing. Like, an Air Force type pilot is given alien powers. Yeah. That's Green Lantern. Yeah. That's also Carol Danvers.
There's as much linkage there as there's between Deadpool and Deathstroke, which is a conversation we're having off mic, and that I don't believe that Deathstroke and Deadpool have that much in common.
They generally don't, but it is still known to be.
Someone could still
know that Deathstroke was the influence.
What if Deadpool put on an eye patch?
Oh, well, then he's Deathstroke.
He's 100% Deathstroke.
Yeah,
if Deadpool puts on an eye patch and buccaneer boots, he becomes Deathstroke.
We wouldn't be able to tell him apart in a room.
Yeah, that's true.
He's dressed up like a pirate before. So.
What are we talking about?
The Captain Marvel. So
right. I think it's a good idea.
I do, too. I'm curious to see what the origin is. I'm curious if...
Will they then retcon it into the comics?
I assume.
Probably should.
I don't know. I wonder if the Kree Captain Marvel will be involved in any way. Like, are they going to do Mar-Vell?
Is the next Guardians of the Galaxy going to hit before her book?
Yes.
Films? So here's what I'm going to guess. They set it up in some way there. That's
maybe.
Their sting, yeah. You know, something that goes on in there ends with somebody landing on Earth or, you know, her getting hit by a beam from one of their ships. Yeah, something's going
to
happen.
Like that. Maybe so. There are rumors that Lando is going to be in the Han Solo movie.
Yeah.
The Han Solo prequel. And there are rumors that Donald Glover is the leading choice to play him.
Which would be great. I thought that the Lando thing was like set in stone.
Is it 100% for sure?
I don't know.
Okay. I don't know for sure.
I thought only the casting was up in the air. But anyway.
I like Donald Glover. I don't know if he's my Lando.
Do you think, do you think he like doesn't have the sort of, the suave?
Yeah. Here's the thing.
Can he do it?
I just came off of The Get Down and Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah.
So I have a whole bunch of people in my head who could play Lando.
Yeah.
Like, I really think the guy who is one of the leads of The Get Down, who was also the lead of the movie Dope.
Yeah.
That guy could be Lando.
I can't remember the dude who played Dre in there. Corey Hawkins. Yeah.
He's going to be busy on 24.
Yep.
Oh, is he 24?
He's the new 24
guy. I am 24.
He is 24.
But, Donald Glover, was he in The Martian?
Yeah.
He's in The Martian. He can play serious, but I don't know if he can play suave.
There as well.
You know what my fear is, Randy?
Yeah.
And if they cast him, they'd be like, what if that turns out to be a persona that was put on by a geeky kid who just had to put on a persona to survive in the fast-paced world of smugglers and con artists?
Yikes. Yeah, that's not a great idea.
I would hate that.
Yeah, me too.
I'm like...
Yeah,
I don't know what I feel like Lando's origin is.
I don't know that
I'm sure that's somewhere written in an expanded universe, but I don't want him to be somebody who's putting on an act.
Well, the thing is, Billy Dee Williams has sort of that charm and that swagger.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he had a sense of humor and a roguish thing, and Donald Glover has that roguish, but not, I don't know. He's always playing a little more nerdy, a little more, even his like Childish Gambino persona that he has is a little bit... It's not what I think of as Lando.
Right.
So I'm not sure. I mean,
is that an ironic personality?
No, not really. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to describe.
Yeah.
I'm not as excited about this as everybody else is, but I'm sure he'll be fine. I just kind of hope that they go a different direction.
It's kind of stunt casting in the sense that Lando doesn't need to be somebody famous, but they're putting in somebody who's kind of like, if not famous, a strong cult actor. Yeah. And I hope that doesn't override sort of appropriate casting.
Yeah.
You know, for all I know, he may have it within him to do an amazing impression of Billy Dee Williams.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to be careful because you don't want somebody who seems like they're doing an impression of somebody.
Yeah.
You want it to sound natural. I mean, the dialogue he had to work with was bad, but what's his name in the prequels who played Obi-Wan?
Ewan McGregor?
Ewan McGregor did make it sound fairly natural. He didn't sound like he was just doing an imitation.
Right.
And, you know, you would hope for at least that kind of level.
Speaking of prequels and Star Wars, by the way, it is very ballsy of them, after having said, you know what, we're going to do sequels and make them good, to go back and be like, hey, let's make some Star Wars prequels. I hadn't thought it occurred to me until right now, but they're doing a Han Solo, which is a prequel, and they're doing Rogue One, which is a prequel. So they're like, you know what, not only are we going to make Star Wars good, we're going to make Star Wars prequels good.
That's true.
That is ballsy as hell.
Although these are almost less prequels and more like side stories. I mean, yes, I know technically they fulfill that, but they're not prequels to the big story stuff.
Yeah, but Han Solo is kind of a prequel. I mean, that's...
I mean, yes, it is technically, but those original Star Wars prequels had to fill in epic mythology in the storyline.
That's true.
And all these have to do is be good, you know, character stories.
Well, Rogue One is looking promising because that new trailer dropped.
Yeah.
And it was great.
You know, I liked it, but I wasn't wowed by it.
Oh, man. I was all over that trailer. The gathering of the team thing. I know you have a fondness for the gathering of the team thing.
Sure, sure.
And I loved seeing the little gathering of the team moments in this trailer.
You know what's funny is I can't quite remember how it was shown. Is it like recruitment scene?
They recruit the droid. She recruits this other pilot who's played by one of the Game of Thrones guys.
Yeah, I like the sound of that droid. That was pretty cool. It was a big old tall droid.
Yeah. And then they recruit Donnie Yen in that really badass sort of like Force monk scene. I'm all over this. This looks really great to me.
It's Force Whitaker. It's going to win.
Force Whitaker is the big draw for me, honestly. Although the lead actress and you see more of the dude who's like kind of her opposite in it.
Yeah.
And well, not opposite, her partner, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't
guy's from Game of Thrones. You haven't seen him yet.
Is he the pilot?
Yeah.
Who's he playing in Game of Thrones?
The pilot. He's the pilot.
Okay, in there too. And what briefly you see with him in the trailer, I thought looked pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited about it. I've watched the trailer a couple of times. And
and also the Beastie Boys sabotage edit.
Yes, I watched the Beastie Boys sabotage edit.
You know, I started watching that, and I realized I was seeing clips in there that maybe it's just from the new one, but I was like, I thought these were like, there were some bits in there that I hadn't seen anywhere.
No, I think they just cut the trailers together.
I thought they might be pulling... The trailer dropped, and there was a few more scenes.
That's what I was wondering, because I was like, there was no way I saw that scene. I saw part of it, but I definitely didn't see
that. Because I know there was a little bit more Donnie Yen, and there maybe just a little
bit. Okay, so they're just splicing in probably some of the international trailer.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we got a little bit more CW news. I didn't read all of this because I didn't want to be all spoiled on it, but I know that they've cast Miss Martian in Supergirl.
Oh, did they?
I've heard that she's happening. That's all I knew.
Oh, yeah. I don't know who they've actually cast her, but having Miss Martian is great because it's going to be interesting to have Jon Jones having an actual, like, Martian protege of sorts.
Yeah, that would be...
And she makes perfect sense with their version of Kara.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that.
You know, you know that Teen Titans show got canceled for what network was it going to run on? Remember that?
TBS. No, TNT.
TNT. I wonder if there's any way they could sneak it in, start building it here.
I could see it.
They've got one member in. You know, I'm trying to think. They probably wouldn't do Robin, right?
Right.
Which is probably the biggest thing. Yeah, although. Yeah,
you could have
that was his I'm leaving the Teen Titans persona though.
Yeah.
But you could have him sort of access out of Bloodhaven.
Actually, you know what? I take that back. He was Nightwing with the Titans for a while, right?
Yeah,
for a good chunk. So that wasn't like I'm gone. So they could do Nightwing, and if they wanted to, they could cross the boundary, you know, a year or two out or whatever and have him.
Well, actually, I mean, having
reference something... Batman, like I don't know if there's like a particular reason why they would just never do
it. Here's the thing, because they've said they would never do Superman on TV again.
Yeah.
They're doing Superman on TV.
Yeah,
it could be sort of a.
I think things move when things work. Yeah.
So I mean, if it makes sense to have, you know, reference Batman or Bruce Wayne or whatever.
I was just thinking, Supergirl deals specifically with aliens. That means Starfire is an easy get.
Yeah.
If they wanted to.
Raven's not the craziest thing to do. I mean, Raven
could show up as somebody who's just on the radar or who's a medic.
Honestly, with Arrow having dealt with all of magic, Raven is an easy get.
Yeah.
Because of Trigun and all the other craziness.
Yeah. Now, I don't necessarily think that that's what they have in mind right now, but if this question goes over well, we'll see.
All right, and then Mirror Master is going to be on The Flash, so they're adding another rogue.
Yep, he was, if I'm not mistaken, he was the last main rogue that, well, I guess, have they done the top?
No, the top's not a main rogue.
No, but like, I can, part of it. But he's definitely one of the rogues.
Yeah.
He's like the last sort of namey one that
Mirror Master's the big one.
Mirror Master's the big one.
You get Captain Cold, Heatwave, Pied Piper.
Have they said which one it is?
They haven't. I haven't dug that in far into
it. No, they did. But I'm blanking. I think it's not the Scottish guy.
Oh, it's not the Scottish guy?
Probably the first guy.
I think it's the first guy.
Oh, yeah. Too bad I like the Scottish guy.
Well, then when he dies, you can have your Scottish guy.
For all I know, they might be merging them and being like, we're using this guy's name and this guy's Scottish accent.
Yeah. all right. Finally, in the news, we have a little more detail from Star Trek Discovery, which I'm getting more and more excited about.
I feel like the time is right for Star Trek.
I agree. And I'm not even as big a Star Trek fan as you. I'm like, I've watched a lot of it, but I don't care if there's a Star Trek series. But I've come to realize with all the disappointing movies that I don't want Star Trek in the movies. I want Star Trek on TV.
It does seem like it's its natural environment.
So there was the Television Critics Association summer tour was going on. Brian Fuller, who is the creator and executive producer of Star Trek Discovery, showed up and answered, you know, gave a little pitch. There's some revelations. Then they had specific questions, which are nutty, and I always like to look at those. So here's what we know. The show will be set 10 years before Star Trek, the original series. The main character will be a woman, but not a captain. Fuller said...
That's actually pretty notable.
Fuller said we've seen six characters from the captain's point of view. I don't know if he means six shows or six characters is a weird way to put it, but I think I know what he means.
Yeah, I mean, basically there have been six Star Trek shows based around captains.
In order to understand something that's so completely alien from her, she first understand herself. That's part of our journey on this planet, to get along, and that's part of our journey in the first season. It's a weird quote, but I think I get what he's saying.
Yeah, the question is like... I assume that she's going to be some kind of point of view character, which could be really interesting. A new person who's sort of essentially graduated to the bridge level work on there.
Yeah.
I can't quite, you know, generally the reason why they've always done the captain is because that guy works with everybody.
Yeah.
And they even, of course, traditionally in Star Trek give the captain stuff to do that you would never actually do. Like, he's always on the missions and away missions, which is ridiculous, but it's good TV.
Yeah.
So, if she's not kind of part of that inner circle, she must have some role, you know, it must be the equivalent of...
Well, we don't know if she is. She may be part of the inner circle. She could be the first officer for all we know.
Picard, in particular, like in the Next Generation era, was always doing like staff meetings. You know, you would get everybody at the table throwing in their suggestions on whatever the problem is. That didn't happen too often on classic Trek, I just think that you know, if they're doing that kind of stuff, that would allow her to have a pretty major role in whatever big stuff is going on.
By the way, the notion of having staff meetings on your show, just like all right, this is the episode where they have a meeting.
It's not staff meetings. They're mission briefings, yes. Randy.
That sounds cooler.
I don't know.
But they were staff meetings.
No, he wasn't giving an evaluation.
But he'd gather everybody in a room, and they'd have space donuts.
But he'd be like, what do you think we should do about the Borg? They're attacking now.
And you're saying those are better than most of the staff meetings we have.
Well, they deal with the Borg better than we do.
That's true. Although I still think that would have worked if you hadn't stopped me.
I just let them assimilate everybody. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's cool. we'll just roll with it. Let them fight. All right. First season will consist of 13 episodes. The show is a whole serialized, playing out like a novel, each episode being a chapter. He said, we have episodes that exist by themselves, but they're much part of a much bigger story. This makes me very happy. 13 episodes... This is not the way CBS does things.
Yeah.
I love the 13-episode model, and I love the serialized one-story model.
Yep. Yeah, that means you should get the, standalone episodes are generally what has been Trek's strength over the years, and it was not probably really until, like, Deep Space Nine that they fully got into the notion of kind of arcs.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there were bits and pieces. There were, like, two-parters and stuff in Next Generation.
Yeah.
But it's usually not been their forte, but for sure, as other TV shows have pioneered that, and merging that with a bit more with Trek, where, you know, you've got some sort of overarching thing, but still keep the standalone episodes, sounds like the perfect mix.
Yeah. He noted, as we've told before, expect a diverse cast and crew and a full range of alien species the crew will encounter. There will be a regular gay character.
That's one of those, by the way, weird things that Star Trek has not really breached. They, for all their kind of progressive thing, they've never just had a straight up gay character that I can.
No, but I remember there was a big controversy in like the 90s when they had like same sex couples like holding hands in the background, okay, walking through the corridors of Star, really? of the Enterprise, and people were flipping out about it.
Did they get away with it? Because I remember there was like that weird thing where like Mirror Universe Kira on like DS9 was like had the hots for her alternate world self.
You know, that was really common, and Buffy did that too. Remember that Willow was like, yeah, she was gay in the alternate universe before they actually made Willow, right, gay.
It was, and it was also kind of the sexy lipstick lesbian, yes, thing. You know, yeah, it was clearly it was a little prurient.
Yeah,
let's just say. It's almost like those. I almost can't count that as being, yeah, progressive.
Well, Fuller said that they're answering a writer's question. There will be robots on Discovery, huh, and in terms of aliens, the show will feature more aliens than you normally do in a Star Trek show. New, exciting aliens, and also reimagining of existing aliens.
So, you know, maybe that means we're finally going to get a Gorn crewman.
Maybe.
Actually, that could be fun if they played it right.
And then they had specific questions, and again, some of these are probably pretty crazy, but the answers on these were: there's an incident in the history of Starfleet that's been talked about in previous Star Trek shows but never fully explored. I don't know if that's going to be the first encounter with the Klingons. There's been rumors about that.
Yeah.
That this might have to do with like how the Klingons and the Federation first encounter one another. But something about that. Section 31, that's the covert ops arm of Star Trek,
yeah,
is not directly involved, but that's not to say that might not have some marble through the meat of our season. So there sounds like they might be doing something with that.
Well, you know, if they are meaning to reflect some stuff from our era, certainly the notion of subversive agencies and their overreach,
yeah,
might have some relevance to today.
Yeah. The Discovery ship design is still in progress. They mentioned it'll feature illustrator Ralph McQuarrie's Star Trek Phase II designs, along with those of 1970s-era race cars, Lamborghinis, and James Bond vehicles.
Weird.
That is, yeah, that's a weird touchstone. Someone must have asked a question about Amanda Grayson, Spock's human mother, which, yeah, I believe isn't that, what's her name from Stranger Things?
Winona Ryder.
She played her in the movie.
Says she's not a central part of the show, but we love that character. That to me seems like someone asked a question. He's like, well, I didn't expect that question at all. What are you talking about?
You know, I did see, you know, is this the interview where he also talks about the rest of the cast from the classic show?
No, not really.
There was one, I saw a few people like a little bit worried, because in one of these interviews, they said something like, hey, you know, what do you feel about having like Jerry Ryan on the show, or, you know, some of the other, like, 7 of 9 and some other cast members, and he's like, you know, he said something similar, like, oh, well, I love all of those characters, and he's like, and I'd never say never, and they kind of interpreted that as, like, he's going to do it, but I think he was kind of being nice because
being
they
polite,
were on the,
yeah,
stage with,
yeah,
him, you know? That might be the same thing with, like, Spock's mom. He was just kind of being polite about it.
Well, that's the other thing. There's one more question. It was, basically, it's conceivable the Discovery could feature bridge crew characters from the original series, but for the moment, he's digging what he's got with the new characters and not thinking that far ahead. Sounds like the polite answer, which is, somebody asked, could we see Spock? And he's like, why would you want to? No, we're not going to do Spock. What are you talking about? Like, yeah, you can't give that answer.
The whole point is, now you understand, you know, you could have a little bit of fun with that. Most of the other guys, if it was 10 years before the original show, I guess most of them would be in the Academy,
yeah,
or whatever, but or even pre-Academy.
Yeah.
But Spock, since Vulcans are longer lived and was supposed to have been around a little bit longer than the rest, he could conceivably be out there on a starship. Like, but yeah, I think they would be wise to shy away from, yeah, any sort of crossover fan. Basically, fan service stuff in,
yeah,
general should not be done with this one.
I think the real answer is depends on the ratings.
Yeah.
Because if the show's not doing well, yeah, you're probably going to see Spock pretty early.
That's right.
All right, that wraps up our news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about previews for October. So every month now, we like to go and look at the previews, our catalog of places, stuff we order from Diamond Comics that comes out every month and usually has stuff for the next couple of months. And we're going to talk about some of our picks that we think you guys might want to keep an eye out for.
Yep. You should order these in advance and help us get our numbers right.
Yes. we are looking at the August previews. That is for stuff coming out in October and later. And I'm going to kick it off with a thing that I think everybody's super excited about, maybe doesn't know about yet, but Serenity, No Power in the Verse, number one from Dark Horse. This is another post-Serenity movie miniseries. The last one they did was Leaves on the Wind, and that was a couple of years ago, I think.
Was it?
Yeah.
Have they done anything in post? I thought the only thing they did post-movie was
it Shepherdstown last?
No. Leaves on the Wind was post-Shepherdstown.
Was it? Okay.
Leaves on the Wind was the first thing after the movie.
But was it set after the movie?
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Yeah. No, it wasn't the first thing published after the movie, but it was the thing last
I mean set after.
Yeah.
I thought that Free Comic Book Day story had been actually set after.
Nope. Leaves on the Wind was set after.
I'll have to reread that.
And this one is as well. This is, they're not giving much away about what it's about yet.
That's probably a good idea.
It's written by Chris Roberson, art by Jarjus Janti, the same creative team, I think, that did. So, it's
exciting. And Chris Roberson, for those who don't know, is probably best known for the creation of iZombie.
Yes. More Serenity. Dave, what you got?
Nick, you got something?
I do.
Go for it, man.
Because I think it's fun, and for people who have loved the Fight Club 2, people should check out this coloring book called Bait, which is actually Chuck Palahniuk.
I'd like to pause for a second.
Yes.
I don't think the sentence, people who liked Fight Club should check out this coloring book, has ever been uttered before.
But it should be.
But it should be.
It is now.
No, but this is an interesting idea. It's Chuck Palahniuk and Duncan Fregredo.
Yeah, which is a great artist.
And Lieber Mejo is throwing in there. And actually a bunch of different artists.
Yeah.
And they're all fantastic. Joelle Jones, Mark Sheff, Steve Morris. But basically it's a coloring book with Chuck Palahniuk's stories. You color along and enjoy some insanity.
Yeah, well, that's the weird thing. It's a hardcover.
It is. It's a $20 hardcover.
It's a $20 hardcover, and it's a series of short stories with different artists, and it's a coloring book. It is a really weird, concept.
It's kind of weird amalgamation of storytelling that I think that getting the readers involved and actually coloring the story as you go is a fun idea.
That is pretty cool, actually.
So I think people should check this one out.
Yep.
Dave, since I jumped in front of you, what do you have?
Can I go for it? I'm jumping to the back half of previews because I want to mention new from Titan Publishing is a new Warhammer comic.
Yeah.
We're always getting asked about Warhammer comics. The last time we had one was like 8 or 10 years ago.
Well, yeah, it was
and
a while.
They were good.
Yeah.
Who was putting Boom? Boom was putting it out. They probably did about a half dozen 40K series and about a half dozen Warhammer Fantasy series.
Yep.
They all had stuff to recommend and sometimes actually were really good. Now Titan, who's a UK publisher, is doing it. And the new one is called Warhammer 40K, Will of Iron. I'm just going to actually just read what they say here. There is a hook to it beyond just Warhammer crap. After 1,000 years of warp storms, the Califrax cluster has reopened to the universe, and Baltus and his fellow Dark Angel Space Marines join a strike force sent to explore and secure the region in search of forgotten artifacts and ancient technology. But the forces of Chaos are never far away, and a shameful Dark Angel secret from the Horus Heresy soon leads to a new front in the war. It sounds cool. It's got, like, disgraced Space Marines. It's got, like, a new sort of frontier for them. Dark lost secrets. So.
He had said the writer is one of the guys who writes their like Black Library books. So
I didn't notice that. Yeah,
George
that's cool.
Mann.
So he's a prose writer from the prose school. And I'm going to while I'm in here, I will sneak in one other book from Titan.
Cheater.
Trigger Man number one. This is like a Prohibition era sort of gangster series. Notable for the writers, writer number one is Walter Hill, guy who wrote The Warriors, one of the most famous movies of that era, but also did like 48 Hours and a bunch of other kind of manly man action movies of the 80s. And his co-writer is Matz, M-A-T-Z, who, am I correct, Randy? That is the guy who wrote
The Killer, which we love.
The Killer, yeah. It was a European miniseries about a hitman that was exceptionally well written, kind of somewhat though in the tradition of like a darker version of like Leon the Professional. And anyway, I feel like this should be on people's radar. The plot is very I'm not going to read the plot on this. It sounds like sort of classic noir type stuff, but I believe it's going to be about the delivery. It's going to be about what these guys bring to the table on it, and that you can't get from the summary.
And you didn't mention the artist.
I didn't mention the artist.
Jeff.
Oh, Jeff.
J-E-F. Jeff.
Matt's and Jeff.
Matt's only ever worse. Wasn't the guy who did Art on the Killer also like one of those one name guys?
Probably so.
I think so.
But it looks really cool.
Yeah, the art does look really good. So, all right, those are mine.
All right, while we're cheating, what? I have one pick in Titan as well.
Get the hell out.
You
sicken me.
I'm sorry. Actually, I wanted to mention Warhammer, and you already did, so we're good. All right, so I'm going to jump back, and I want to talk about something DC is doing. Cave Carson has a cybernetic eye.
A what kind of eye?
A cybernetic eye.
Interesting.
We've been talking about this.
I want this, if only for the title, but this is... this is part of the Young Animal imprint, which, by the way, I have a chance to read Doom Patrol.
Yes.
I got a preview copy from DC, as did you guys, but you haven't looked at it yet.
I know. I need to read it.
And it's great and weird and super fun.
I
want
to read the physical copy.
And I'm super excited. So Cave Carson and the Cybernetic Eye is also part of Young Animal, co-written by Gerard Way and John Rivera, who wrote something called Heartbreak. I don't know what that is. Illustrated by Michael Avon Oeming from Powers. And, it's... about an adventurer whose daughter is heading off to college, and widowed Cave Carson is trying to put his life back together and is sent back into the under the earth for his past to deal with, and he's got a cybernetic eye.
So for those who don't know, he is like, and I think we talked about this maybe at some point when we mentioned the Young Animal line, Cave Carson is like an old Silver Age DC hero who is like just like this cave exploring adventurer with his team of guys. Now this seems like it'll probably be kind of like a bonkers take on it.
Yeah.
Or I feel like, you know, Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol is the touchstone conceptually for a lot of these, or Grant Morrison in general.
Yeah.
Is sort of like the touchstone.
And I'm going to mention the other Young Animal book of the month, too, while I do this.
So that
is Shade the Changing Girl, which is written by Cecil Castellucci, who did a lot of young adult novels and wrote The Plain Janes for DC. And drawn by Marley Zarcone, who is the artist on Effigy for Vertigo. And this is about a girl living on Meta, the planet where Shade is from. She's dropped out of school, dumped her boyfriend, is bored out of her mind. She steals the madness code from lunatic poet Rack Shade and makes a break across galaxies to take up residence in a new body, Earth Girl Megan Boyer.
So Rack Shade, by the way, was the original Shade, yeah. The Changing Man.
Yep.
And so, but this is kind of like angsty schoolgirl from an alternate dimension comes to our dimension and tries to hack it.
I think it's going to be easy and realizes that's not actually the case.
Yep. Nick, what else you got?
I want to talk about a DC book.
Okay.
And that is Teen Titans number one. This is Ben Percy, who's been writing Green Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Done really well there. And then art by John Boyd Myers. But this is basically Damian calling on the Teen Titans because he wants to form it himself to deal with Ra's al Ghul. And
that's cool.
It's a fun idea.
I really like that cover, by the way. Is that the interior artist?
I believe that actually is the interior artist, yes.
It's very energetic in that kind of...
It feels like Teen Titans Go.
Umberto Ramos, though, is also what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And even a little bit of... who's that guy who keeps bailing on comics for video games?
Joe Madureira.
Even a little Joe Madureira.
Yes. But I feel like if you make Damian a kind of... They call him a tyrannical teen, which is about right. Everything he says is right. And sort of him wanting to form the Teen Titans is kind of a fun idea.
I have a tough time seeing him leading.
Well,
he is such a little jerk face.
I think that's the thing. And I think if Ben Percy can harness that and sort of make that work.
Starfire would blast him into atoms. But I assume that's where the tension of the book will
rise. Exactly.
But you get Starfire, I agree, this looks fun.
But you get Starfire, you get Beast Boy, you get Raven, and you get Kid Flash.
Yep.
I think... It feels like classic team in a lot of ways.
Yep. The only thing, the one that they don't have in there is Cyborg because he's graduated to Justice League stuff.
But yeah, I'm really excited for it.
It looks good.
Damn, what else you got?
Yep, I'll keep the DC train running for a sec. I wanted to mention. I think we've already discussed this when it was announced. The Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love. I like the pulp romance title of it. I'm just going to go ahead and read what they say about the, read the description of it, but we did talk about this. It's sort of like a young adult, fiction writer, is on the series, and, it does seem like it's taking Dead Man, who is traditionally kind of, you know, a He's a circus guy turned ghost who goes on adventures sometimes.
Sure.
And there's, but they're spinning that in sort of a more of a gothic romance kind of way. So it says, trapped inside an old gothic mansion, dead man must battle forces of darkness alongside Bernice, a young woman with a complicated love life who is gifted or cursed with the ability to communicate with the dead. Romance, mystery, and evil await in the new bi-monthly miniseries. So, oh, that's right. It's Sarah Vaughan from Alex and Ada. Yeah. That's one of the other big draws is where you might be a little bit worried, like, oh, this is kind of a cheap, trashy romance thriller. And, like, remember, Alex and Ada actually had great characters in it.
And is getting a deluxe hardcover in this very preview.
I saw that. I saw that. I also, I'll mention one other DC thing while I'm in the ballpark here. There's a Wonder Woman 75th anniversary special. I don't know what all is going to be in it, other than it seems like it's sort of a jam issue, and it has, like, tons of big names who've worked on her in recent years in it. So Raphael Albuquerque, Brian Azzarello, Cliff Chang, Adam Hughes, Gail Simone. So it's Jim Lee's doing the cover. They say an immense special issue celebrating 75 years of the amazing Amazon through phenomenal new stories, art, and standalone illustrations. So this is going to be, this next year or two is going to be big for Wonder Woman. She's getting the movie, you know, there's new comic series and all that. And there's going to be this fancy special edition, so that all you Wonder Woman fans should get it.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk about Marvel for a little bit. Well, at least one of them.
No.
Champions number one. This is basically all different Avengers, which I've been loving. Post-Civil War, it looks like Ms. Marvel, Nova, and Miles Morales, the younger half of the team, are burning their Avengers membership cards, which is a big deal for Ms. Marvel, by the way. She's such a fangirl.
Yeah.
And going on their own, along with Cyclops from All New X-Men, the new Totally Awesome Hulk, and Viv Vision from the Vision series, to form the Champions.
You know what's weird? I don't really I just don't have any interest in Totally Awesome Hulk in a solo book.
Me neither.
In a team book, I think he could be awesome.
Totally, totally awesome.
No, let's not get carried away.
Somewhat awesome?
Somewhat awesome.
Yeah. I'm with you on that, actually. I'm also not enjoying the solo book that much, but I like the idea of him on this team. And I'm curious to see what Viv Vision's going to be like outside of the sort of horror elements of that book. But we don't know a ton about it. All we know is that it's Mark Waid and Alberto Ramos. Last time they worked together, we had like Impulse from them. So right.
They created a rare modern character that had some sticking power.
And Miles Morales is a modern character with sticking power.
Sure.
He actually has sticking powers.
Whoa.
Yeah. This just has a shot of them walking down a New York subway, and there's like kids around them. And I'm really curious what this is going to be like.
Actually, I kind of, you know, although that's not what you call an exciting action-adventure shot, I like covers like that sometimes for the teen characters, the ones that kind of sort of normalize them a little bit, you know, where they're not necessarily doing giant super stuff, but a little bit more normal stuff.
No, it's all in the attitude, too. This is their peoples, I think.
Nick, what you got?
So I have a Vertigo book to talk about. And I think I may have mentioned this when we were, when it came up.
When I was going through this, I forgot this thing existed.
But this is The Lost Boys number one, which is Tim Seeley's sequel to the Lost Boys movie, featuring, you know, all the same characters that we know. It's basically what happens in the power vacuum after the head of the vampires get killed.
But I thought all the vampires were dead.
But maybe not.
Oh.
And also, a new vampire coven called the Blood Bells has decided to show up.
It's Bells like Southern Bells.
Exactly. Looking for Star and Michael's girl. So it sounds fun. Given the track record that Tim Seeley has with sort of, you know, horror with backslash, this seems like right up his alley.
Yeah, completely. You know, I hope that Epic Sax Man from the opening of Lost Boys makes it in here.
I think, we'll probably get his story.
I need to find out how he got so muscular and oiled.
Also, just as a quick cheater pick, there's a DC Dark Horse Justice League Volume 1 that puts together some of the Batman Hellboy stuff.
Along with, like, Batgirl Ghost. It's some weird
Superman
stuff.
Superman vs. Terminator. Yeah. And Batman Hellboy Starman. Ghost Batgirl. Yeah. Very, very cool stuff, and I'm glad they're finally putting it all together in one trade.
Yeah, now if only Marvel and DC would make up and put the Marvel DC stuff back together in trade.
And just for fun, just because it's a character I think we all enjoy, in All-Star Batman number 3 this year, in this previous, KG Beast stars.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, Oh, KG Beast.
I'm ready for some KG Beast.
I know that this is, like, I believe, continuing the whole road trip
thing. It is the road trip, but same story.
What's weird is, like, that seems a little risky to stretch out for 5 issues. What I liked the appearances of, like, was it Killer Moth? Or yep. Who mm-hmm. as hitmen, you know, kind of teched up hitmen. I hope KG Beast is not reduced to merely being one more hitman. Because I feel like he is a step above. He nearly killed Batman in the past.
It looks like John Romita Jr.'s rendition of his costume is pretty close.
Fairly classic.
Very classic to what he usually is.
I hope they're, like, driving through Kansas and they find out that, like, he retired there and went as protection. But he comes out of retirement to try and take down Batman for the reward.
Actually, if they kind of went with the notion that is, you know, he kind of post-Cold War had sort of got into it, but he was a mean old Russian man now.
Yep.
I'd be down with it.
He should be the cook, like in Hunt for Red October.
Whoa, spoiler warning. Nick, are you done?
I am done.
I'm gonna jump back over to Marvel and follow Randy's lead here. I want to mention Jessica Jones number one.
Yeah.
She is hot off her about a decade old series.
Yeah.
Where did that go? Like about 20, 25 issues?
Yeah, something like that. There's four trades out now.
Yeah, it was a very finite story with about four or five story arcs, and that was it. But now she is getting a new series, no doubt influenced by the strong success of her show, Jessica Jones. And that is actually what this is called, where the previous series was called Alias.
Yep.
They've rebranded it, right?
Jessica Jones co-starring Alias, something like that, yes.
Yeah. So their description says she's back after a decade. A lot has changed in the Marvel Universe, and there are still many secrets hiding in the shadows. Secrets only a special woman like Jessica Jones could hope to uncover. Discover the haunting secrets from Jessica's past in this blistering new series. Alias Investigations is open for business. And it's the original creative team.
It's Brian Bendis and Alex Maleev.
Michael Gatiss.
Michael Gatiss. Yeah. Here's the interesting thing about this for me.
Yeah.
Jessica Jones has changed quite a bit, and Bendis did a lot of changes, but she's married, she has a kid.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if she can still be the same Jessica Jones.
It's hard to see her out there, like, being all super dangerous and self-destructive like she was in her investigations before.
So I'm curious to see what the new Jessica Jones series looks like.
On the complete opposite end.
Yes.
As long as I'm over here at Marvel territory, Cage number one for by Gennady Tartakovsky,
Yay.
A.K.A. the creator of
Powerpuff Girls.
What's the Samurai Jack?
Yeah.
And the original Star Wars Clone Wars animated thing before it went all CG. So what's crazy about this? This is like full on retro blaxploitation, but it also is almost drawn in like Mad Magazine style. It's like his most exaggerated cartoony style. And if you look at it, it's sort of like the underground cartoony artists or even the original Mad Magazine artists like from like the 50s and 60s, like Robert Kurtzman and Jack Davis and those guys. But it looks like he's totally having a blast with sort of 70s tropes. This is Luke Cage full on sporting the yellow silk shirt, the steel headband, the chain belt, you know,
yep.
And buccaneer boots, and tearing up the streets, I assume.
Yeah.
Anyway, it looks like it's going to be a trip, and if you've been missing those elements, I really like the new modern Cage, I have to say. They do a great job, but I'm going to enjoy what promises to be a slightly bonkers 70s-style Cage.
Yep.
All right, Randy, what else you got?
All right, I want to mention an Image book.
Okay.
And it's weird enough that I'm looking forward to a Bendis book, but I'm looking forward to a Mark Miller book. Because Mark Miller's book with Greg Capullo, Reborn number one.
Yeah, don't forget, you're also looking forward to a Greg Capullo book.
Yeah, I'm not a big Greg Capullo fan in general, but the concept on this one sounds great. It's basically... it's when you die, you go to something that's not heaven or hell. It's somewhere you have to fight to survive. And people from their past are waiting for you. And this is going to be sort of an epic love adventure story where, like, I think a guy dies and then goes looking for his lost wife, something like that, or it's vice versa.
I think it's a wife looking for
her lost husband. But it looks really interesting. It looks like sort of fantasy sci-fi, and I'm curious to see where they go with it.
The preview art, Capullo's art does look pretty good in it, I got to say.
Nick, what do you got?
I'm going to jump back to Marvel just for a brief moment, because why not talk about more Doctor Strange stuff?
Yep.
And we have Doctor Strange and the Sorcerer Supreme, number one. And this is going to be written by Robbie Thompson, who's doing Silk right now.
Yep.
and I think the Ollie, or Spidey, right?
Yeah, and more importantly, outside of comics, he's a writer on Supernatural.
Right.
So he's got some chops that belong on Doctor Strange.
And Javier Rodriguez, who is the artist.
Oh, that's right.
And that's the artist from Spider-Woman.
Yeah. One of my favorite artists. I'm actually, much as I'm excited to see this book, I'm really sad to see him leave Spider-Woman.
Yeah, but the notion of this is basically an ancient evil threatens to unravel the fabric of reality, and one Sorcerer Supreme may not be enough. Doctor Strange must unite past, present, and future Sorcerer Supreme to stem the tide, stem the coming darkness. Merlin, the Ancient One, Wiccan, and more. But Strange should watch his back. Not all of these sorcerers have his best interests in mind. I think it's sort of a kind of a road trippy, all Sorcerer Supreme's book sounds kind of fun.
Well, I love the notion that Wiccan is a future Sorcerer Supreme.
Yes,
I love bringing in Merlin.
Yep.
My only issue with this is that when they first announced it, I thought it was going to be a team book with all those cool mystics that he introduced. Where's El Medico Mystico?
Yeah.
Where's the Russian Bear? I want those guys.
But I agree.
But seeing some of Javier Rodriguez's artwork for just sort of design variant stuff, it looks fantastic.
So nice.
I'm just saying, where's my El Medico Mystico miniseries?
I want that as
Get
well.
Get on it, Marvel. all right, what else? Dave, what you got?
Let's see. All right, let me jump to one of my random spots here. I'm going to mention that there was a Labyrinth one-shot that was pretty cool.
Sold out immediately.
We got more on the order that should, by the time people are hearing this, we should have back in and fill the special orders on. But you might want to jump on this one ahead of time and let us know if you're interested, because it's a little bit pricey. It's a hardcover art tribute book, $25, a lot of comic artists, and let's see, I'm looking to see what all is in this. I think it's all just illustrations. Oh, interesting, it says sort of testimonials too, so people may be posting about their memories of seeing it. But it has a really nice cover here by Steve Morris. Let's see. I'm just going to throw out some of the artist names. So, Mike Allred, Mark Buckingham, Jonathan Case, Faith Aaron Hicks, Mike Huddleston, Fraser Irving, Joel Jones, Tula Lotte, David Mack, Dustin Nguyen, Eric Powell, Craig Thompson, Jill Thompson. It's a huge list of notable artists.
Yeah.
And they're all going to be having fun, I'm sure, playing in the playground of Jim Henson's world. So let us know if you are interested. It is probably going to be another one of those that we'll probably order a little light on, just because it's a little pricey. So it'll go fast when it comes.
I want to mention some Dark Horse collections. They're doing some omnibus format stuff. So these are like, I don't know, 400 pages. Like 472 pages is the Conan one. So these big collections, $25. You get almost 500 pages of Conan, and this is Busick and Nord stuff. So it's the first three volumes they run, Born on the Battlefield, Frost Giant's Daughter, and God in the Bowl.
Uh-huh.
That's great stuff. For $25, that is a huge value. And it's also gorgeous, really interesting. I actually have all the original trades, but if you missed out on it, you want some Conan, that is great. But they're also this month doing similar collections for Mass Effect and for Dragon Age. So I think the Mass Effect one contains more or less the entire Mass Effect run they've done.
I feel like they might have enough to make two omnibus.
They do. But it collects the first four story arcs: Redemption, Evolution, Invasion, and Homeworlds.
That's a ton of stuff.
$25, 400 pages. And it's all co-written by Mac Walters, who was one of the writers on the game. It's all in canon. And then Dragon Age is the same way. It's the lead writer, David Guider, is the guy who writes it, along with somebody else. And it contains three miniseries. It's only 200 pages, so, you know. Merely
200.
But yeah, all those omnibuses are coming out, which is pretty cool. Nick, what else you got?
I have an Image book that I'd like to talk about.
Okay.
And that is Moonshine number one.
Yeah, I'm curious about this one.
And this is Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Rizzo. It's one of, they like to team up together, so this is another one of theirs. But it's about set during Prohibition and deep in the backwoods of Appalachia. Moonshine tells the story of Lou Prilo, a city slick torpedo sent from New York City to negotiate a deal with the best moonshiner in West Virginia. So it feels a little bit like Prohibition Justified in some ways.
Yeah, Prohibition Justified, yeah.
But basically he finds out that this moonshiner is just as devious as any New York City crime boss.
Right.
So I like the sort of
the battle boys that versus might the be hits. There.
And here's the other thing. I believe there's a horror twist to this.
Oh,
Which, and I don't want to give too much. I don't want to give too much away. But if you look at the logo, and you think of the title Moonshine, you probably figure it out.
Yeah, you could probably do that. So I think that'll be kind of fun. It's going to look gorgeous because Eduardo Risso doesn't know how to do anything but gorgeous at this point.
Yeah.
So I'm excited.
It's gorgeous, but he also does kind of gritty too.
Yeah.
Kind of a gritty noir thing.
Yeah.
Dave?
I'm going to mention two bonkers team-up books, crossover books.
I considered this.
He-Man Thundercats, number one.
Yep.
That has art. If I'm not mistaken, those covers, Freddie Williams, is that the same guy who did the Ninja Turtles art? The Batman team?
Yeah, it is.
It was looking familiar. I didn't read the thing on this, but I feel like it's self-explanatory. It's He-Man, it's Thundercats.
Sure.
And then there's Archie Meets the Ramones.
Yeah.
One-shot. Again, I feel it's self-explanatory. What I did not notice is whether this is going to be in that kind of the modern style of Archie or like the classic cartoony style.
I'm not
of
sure
Archie.
Either. Do we know who the artist is?
Let's see. Giselle Legace?
I don't know.
Also, I just noticed while I was looking at this He-Man Thundercats, I had a quick mention. Harley's Little Black Book number 6 is notable because it has Harley and Lobo. That's like her the Harley team-up book.
Sure.
Which has a great cover by Amanda Connor, but it also has art by Simon Bisley.
Oh, wow.
Who did all the crazy Lobo specials of like the 90s when you were probably, everybody was obsessed with Lobo.
Essentially, he was the co-creator even though he didn't write his original or draw his original origin.
So, all the old school Lobo fans, and I should say, this is old school Lobo. It's not new school, new 52 Lobo.
Interesting. Okay.
So you're gonna probably want to check this out because it's probably gonna fit right in with your Lobo paramilitary Christmas special.
All right, I'm just gonna run down my list, speed round real quick, and then we'll do the same for you guys. Batman Beyond number 1, which is Terry McGinnis returns as Batman Beyond. So I'm kind of cool to see that.
About time.
Vigilante Southland, which is a new vigilante series that from DC that's Gary Phillips crime novelist working on it. Absolute Wonder Woman, which is the first collection of the Brian Azzarello, Cliff Chang, and oversized hardcover format. I'm definitely going to be picking this up. I don't know how. If you want it, definitely order it from us because we don't tend to order those for the shelf, but I'm looking forward to it. Corgi Volume 4 is coming out. This is the silent stories of the adorable Corgi dog lives amongst fairies and breathes fire. glad to see that finally returning, and that means the other three volumes will be back too. Spider-Man Clone Conspiracy is spinning off from the Amazing Spider-Man story. It's going to be the Jackal versus Spidey. Mm-hmm. It's Dan Slott writing. Solo number 1, which is their terrorist fighting character over at Marvel. He gets his own solo series. And it's by Jerry Dugan.
Merca.
Mosaic number 1 is a new character who is a, I want to say he's like a professional, he's like a basketball player, I think. And the first thing that happens when he gets his powers is it disintegrates his body. And so he has to, he can like inhabit other people's bodies.
Right.
So that's a shot at new character from them. Always good to see. Volume 2 Star Wars hardcover. Darth Vader's hardcover collects the rest of that book. Black Widow Volume 1 comes out this month, and I'm really, really a fan of that Black Widow series. Shipwreck number 1 is an Aftershock comic written by Warren Ellis.
Finally, G.I. Joe's Shipwreck is getting his day.
If only.
It's also notable the artist on that, too.
Who is the artist on that?
Phil Hester.
Phil Hester, that's right.
Oh, nice.
The Skeptics, number 1, I don't know a ton about, except that it's Black Mask, and Black Mask has been on a roll for me lately.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, DC Encyclopedia, those big hardcover encyclopedias, new is getting edition. A new updated edition with, I'm sure, all the various updates since last time they did one.
Nice.
Dave, you have anything else you want to run through real quick?
Yeah, I'll give you a quick run through here. I did want to quick mention, this is a weird trade paperback coming out, and I see that these are collections from that Legends of Tomorrow anthology, specifically Sugar and Spike, Metahuman Investigation.
Yeah.
Now, what caught my attention was, A, I was like, what is this? I've never seen this particular version. But it's written by Keith Giffen, who's never been a favorite writer, but has had lots of runs I've enjoyed over the years. And the art looked really pretty cool. And it looks like, so Sugar and Spike were old DC kid characters, kid comic strips from like the Bronze Age.
Yeah.
And have been reinvented a few times, and I'm curious to see what the deal is with this one. It's coming out as a trade. There's a new Star Trek series called Star Trek Boldly Go that continues the movie, relaunches the movie character stuff. Did you mention this, Randy?
No.
Green Valley, number 1 from Skybound. That's Image's, Image's thing. So the notable thing is this looks like a fairly lushly drawn or painted fantasy series written by crazy and polarizing Max Landis.
Yeah.
But people have been following his American Superman American Alien will may be more inclined towards kindness at it for him at the moment. Just don't watch his YouTube videos. But I'm curious to see what he's going to do with a sort of fantasy series.
Yep.
Let's see. There's a new James Bond coming out that's written by Andy Diggle.
Looking forward to that.
James Bond Hammerhead. It's just a miniseries.
Is this one where he fights a hammerhead shark?
Yes. I'm just going to say yes. Let's see. And lastly, I want to mention from Tundra Books a book called Narwhal Volume 1, Unicorn of the Sea. I don't know anything about this, but the art on it on the cover is adorable. And it says... the first in a series of, it even says it, funny and adorable graphic novels starring exuberant, happy-go-lucky, waffle-loving narwhal and his cynical sidekick, Jelly, who's a jellyfish.
Huh.
Anyway, it looks adorable, and I feel like you should get it for your kids, everybody.
Nick, you have anything else to add?
I have two more things. I was very happy to see Robin Volume 3 resolicited in this.
Oh, cool.
This is the collection of the 90s Robin stuff.
Yeah, so this actually is the beginning of his series, so it's issues 1 through 6 and then the two annuals.
Okay, yeah.
And then there was one last one that I thought was kind of fun, Spookhouse number 1, which is Eric Powell presents the first in an all-new anthology series of scary campfire stories for kids.
Okay.
Because Eric Powell and kids don't really go together.
Let's just hope it's not as R-rated as all his other stuff has been lately. Actually, but he's also done PG-13 before.
Yeah.
But if it sort of falls in line with like the Goosebumps...
Yeah, it's a fun idea.
It's a fun idea. We'll see.
All right. That wraps up the previews for us, and we'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, August 17th, and Nick, why don't you kick us off here?
Sure. I'm going to talk DC because they've been on my radar a lot lately, and this one is Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 1. So this is taking place right after the Rebirth issue, sort of Huntress is kind of like the traditional Huntress that we know, even though she's Spiral, she's still the mob boss's daughter.
She always seemed like she was a little, like, classic Huntress was always kind of slightly out of Batman's control.
Correct.
Yeah.
This is, I don't think she's ever in Batman's control. she's not in Nightwing's control. She's out of control in a lot of ways.
She's still rebellious and dangerous?
Oh, yes. She's completely dangerous. And this is sort of telling how she teams up with Babs and Dinah. And sort of continues the story of finding the person impersonating Oracle.
Have they met her before in this, in, like, New 52 continuity?
No, they haven't.
Okay, interesting.
This is basically, they only know her through Nightwing.
Okay.
And sort of what maybe he said about her, and just brief snippets.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting to sort of have your cake and eat it too, because you're seeing this connection for the first time, but it's still sort of like the Huntress that you knew.
Right, right. It's not a radical overhaul or anything.
No, but I like what... the Benson, I guess they're sisters, right?
Yeah,
they are. Who worked on the 100. I like what they're bringing to the table here. I like their interpretation of Barbara Gordon, sort of because someone's utilizing her name and namesake and knows all of her stuff, she's kind of out of control herself because it's very personal to her.
Right, it's like identity theft to the nth degree.
And Black Canary is sort of the kind of reserved one at this point. She's kind of keeping Barbara in check. Where
she's a rock and roll superstar.
Exactly, she's the rock and roll superstar. And it's got just some fun action. They're going up against mobsters, but, also because it's Gotham, you've got the superpower villains.
Yep.
It's a character that controls snakes.
Are they still based out of Gotham as is traditional?
Yep, they've got some classic digs, you might say. They have the old clock tower.
Nice.
Which is a cool reference back to their original stuff. And it's just a fun action book. I really enjoyed it. I think it does what it needs to do. So I'm happy that.
I don't know what that is on the last page, but it's interesting looking.
Yeah. No, I'm enjoying it. So that is my pick.
Dave?
My pick was a kind of pleasant surprise this week. I guess this is a one-shot, right?
Yeah.
Has to be. It's a tie-in to Marvel's Civil War. It's called Civil War, or rather Civil War II, The Fallen. I don't know any way to talk about this without spoiling.
It's who, about Lucifer.
Without spoiling who died in the.
I think we're clear about
it. In the an issue or two back in Civil War. But at this point, I believe people know the Hulk is dead.
Yeah.
Put down by an arrow from Hawkeye.
Bruce Banner. Because there really is another Hulk running around right now.
Technically, yeah. But when I say the Hulk, people don't think of Amadeus Cho. Sorry, kid. So he's dead, and this is effectively a eulogy sort of issue. It's written by Greg Pak, who definitely knows from the Hulk. He wrote two of the most famous Hulk events, the Planet Hulk, where he was stranded on that alternate on another world and mm-hmm. was like a space gladiator, basically. And World War Hulk, where he came back to Earth not too happy about that stuff. Among other things, having lost his wife at the time.
And now he's writing the new Totally Awesome Hulk.
Right. So he's basically back hip deep in Hulkness again.
He's written some of the best Hulk stuff. Mm-hmm.
And I would count this among them. I'm not surprised that he had a strong sense of this. It's in the beginning you see his funerals going on, and there's protesters outside. There's people who have been upset at the Hulk over the years for destroying their neighborhoods or whatever. And then you see individual people kind of eulogizing him at the funeral. So Tony Stark has words about it. Ben Grimm steps up and he says, I think I fought him more than anybody else. And I hate to say it, but he really was the strongest one there was. And, there's these great character moments, and those are just the first of many throughout. And I also appreciated the kind of, as there's protests going on outside, somebody comments like they're not remembering all the times he saved the world, basically.
Yeah.
Saved, thousands and millions of people. And from there, the issue kind of jumps around to other people who are close to him. So you've got Amadeus Cho, Rick Jones, his son, Scar.
I was very happy to see some of his war bond.
His co-gladiators. And some of these characters, I was talking about this with Randy, I haven't seen in a while.
Yeah.
And I don't have, a special attachment to the Warbound, but they are very well written here,
You have a Brood Queen that's just sitting there.
That's not helping my case, Nick. People don't care about no Brood Queen.
Yeah, but they're cool.
But they are cool, and this is all about how they remember Hulk, and specifically, they have that sort of warrior's honor for him. But everybody sort of lenses him in different ways, and there's also I thought a really fantastic scene in it where they kind of... You've seen this sort of thing in TV shows and movies before where a tape or something is left behind by somebody who dies, and they're like, oh, if you're getting this, then I've probably died, and here's my last words, or my will, and stuff like that. Bruce Banner's got one. And I was very, very happy with everything that went on in that. I'm happy with the stuff that this set up. It's actually, there's some humor occasionally in this. There's some sweet stuff and some sad stuff. But I felt it was it's just about everything that I would want in a good tribute to a fallen hero. Randy, you liked it as well.
I agree. Yeah. I was not expecting to like this, and I thought it was a really good solid one shot.
Isn't the fallen sort of what they do, what Marvel does for their events? Cause didn't they have a Captain America?
They did one for Captain America, and they did one for Sentry.
Yeah. Okay. So that's kind of their generic, when a hero dies.
Right. But this one is good.
This one is good. Yeah. We're actually sad about the Hulk, not so sad about Sentry.
No.
All right. And Randy, what is your...
My pick is not a Marvel or a DC book.
Oh, fancy man.
That's right. It's a Dark Horse book. It's called Briggs Land Number 1. And this is Brian Wood, artist Mac Chater, who is not a guy I know, but who has, Dave noted earlier, kind of looks like a Michael Lark, one of those guys.
Kind of people who works with Greg Rucka or... Ed Brubaker sometimes.
Yeah, sort of very realistic, very little photo referenced.
Yep.
But this is about Briggsland, USA. It's 100 square miles of rural wilderness owned and controlled by the Briggs family, a community of anti-government secessionists. The patriarch of the family, Jim Briggs, has continued to run his empire while incarcerated until today when Grace, his wife, takes over for herself. So basically it opens with Grace, the sort of older woman who is basically cutting her husband out of running the family business, which is a militia, basically.
Right, and this guy is, serious about it. He's, got, almost the way mobs have ties. He has ties within the town and people he's paying off. And she's daring to get in between that.
Yeah, so this is all about sort of her dealing with her various sons who are, by turns, like a white supremacist guy, a guy who just came back from serving in the military, sort of a wild man who's out on hunts with other guys.
Looks like there was one of them who's like, yeah, they like ran into some trouble with bikers,
yeah.
Shootout.
And it's sort of all about the what happens when a sort of a dangerous organization, what happens when someone changes hands there, and it's got that sort of that mob feel a little bit, you know, like the mob family's changing hands.
But you know what I just realized? It reminded me of Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah,
where you've got characters you actually kind of like care about. But some of them are doing very bad things, but there's degrees of sort of honor and family ties between them that make you identify with them, even as you're like, you know, your brother is a white supremacist, right?
Yeah, there's they also have a couple of federal agents who are looking into them, and they're sort of our point of view characters because they're sort of explaining it to each other, talking about the case, and also at the same time explaining it to the reader.
Yeah.
It was really good. I wasn't sure I was going to like this. I'm not always as big on Brian Wood stuff as say Dave is, but I thought it was a really good, strong first issue.
Yeah, and I suppose unsurprisingly I liked it, although I haven't liked everything he's done. Like, you know, Northlander's never fully clicked for me.
Yeah.
This one I think is one of his most approachable ones.
Yeah, I agree.
And a very relevant topic to kind of get inside the workings of a militia. I mean, it seems like he's also kind of thinking about it. I mean, it is like about the family stuff within it. But I feel like he's done a lot of research and reading on this.
Yeah.
So it has the feel of, like, here's also what the FBI know about how militias operate and stuff. Like, you know, you're getting kind of an insider's look at kind of an ugly side of America.
Yeah. No surprise, my backup pick is a book that I've picked numerous issues of. That's Captain America, Sam Wilson, number 12. This continues to be just a fantastic book. There's an opening flashback to, you know, early days when Cap goes to get Falcon out of prison where he has been placed by the cops who thought he was the bad guy and Trapster was the good guy because Trapster's white and Falcon was black. This is unapologetically Spencer doing his sort of political riff.
You know what's weird is I know that they've probably done some version of scenes like that before, but I can't recall a scene in a comic off the top of my head that echoed that reality for superheroes.
But it's got basically Rage, the vigilante hero, has gotten into it with the AmeriCops, the new private cops that are out there, and Sam goes to try and de-escalate the situation, which does not go well. At the same time, these guys, both the head of the AmeriCops is a Texas corporate guy and a couple of Texas senators are trying to talk John Walker, the U.S. agent who they've recalled back from Afghanistan. They're trying to talk him into going and taking the shield back from Sam Wilson. And
that definitely sounds like my home state.
There's some nice sort of nuance in their take on sort of the conservative guys too. But this is unapologetically a liberal point of view, which makes sense.
Isn't something I necessarily expect from him, but
yeah.
I appreciate that. And I really want to read this. I'm also looking at that art from Daniel Acuna.
Daniel Acuna's art is great. The thing I like about this book is it reminds me of what Gruenwald was doing, and it's definitely influenced by Gruenwald stuff. The AmeriCop was Gruenwald's creation. It's basically taking these like political things, but it's not all about politics. It is using them as a lens through which to do superhero stories. So it's going to be, you know, Rage versus Falcon, but in a different way.
Right.
Captain America versus U.S. Agent, but in a different way. And I like that it's still a superhero book, even though it's got these sort of political overtones.
Right.
And it's really beautiful, and I think it's one of my favorite books right now.
Dave, what is your backup pick?
Nick, did you already do your backup
pick? No, it's your turn first.
We do in reverse.
My God, that's right. My backup pick is the final issue of Claws from Grant Morrison,
yep.
A.K.A. Santa Claus 01.
Klaus.
This is issue 7 of what had previously been like a 4 or 5 issue series.
Yep.
And became 7 over time because I think they were just like, let the man's story breathe.
Let him write.
And let the Dan Mora's artwork breathe.
Yes. Well, this is a big sort of action-oriented final issue. I'm sure I can see that probably some of the space went to this one to let the finale show up. Like, demons have been summoned. I don't know if they ever call it by name, but it's very clearly a Krampus-type demon.
Okay.
In all its horror and glory. And it's got, last stands for characters, big heroic moments, brutal paybacks for a few bad people, and as one would hope, a sort of hopeful Santa Claus Christmassy type ending.
Nice.
And that's the, you know, I was kind of waiting to see how this turned out to see if I was ultimately going to want to pick it up, and this ended up firmly in the camp of yes. One other thing I was going to mention is there's a plot point in this that happened that's as far as like, you know, getting the Santa story in place.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, I can't believe I didn't see that coming. Like, I feel really stupid for not having realized it, that that was an obvious direction of the story. Which I guess is a compliment to the book, though, for putting some things into place without me thinking, oh, this is going to be this and this is going to be that.
Right.
Anyway, good final issue. So enjoy the ending and or watch for the collected edition in a month or two.
Yep.
Whenever it hits.
I want to talk about my backup pick is a not from Marvel or DC. It's actually from Boombox, which I think is Boom's. Is it all ages?
Yeah, no, it's their creator own.
It's their creator own line. And this is from James Tynion, who's been writing Detective Comics, art by Ryan Sieg. It's called The Backstagers, Act One. Just sort of a kind of fun little romp about a all boys school and about a young boy who doesn't really fit in anywhere. And he finds one place he thinks he can fit in, which is the drama club, but ends up finding out that they might not be the people he wants to be with, but maybe the people who set the stage or who are backstage, they're a little bit more his speed.
Okay.
And there's some interesting kind of weird creatures running around backstage. The backstage is all about magic and mystery, and there's just some fun ideas at play here. Fun, really great characters. The art has that sort of Steven Universe animated style to it.
Yeah, it's funny. I see one character that looks straight out of Steven Universe and a few characters that are a little bit more realistic.
Yeah.
I guess that was like... that particular character, I think, just has the Steven Universe look.
Well, you know, Boombox's other stuff includes Lumberjanes, Giant Days, and Goldie Vance.
Right. They've also staked out...
I feel like this fits into that.
So yeah. Kind of an all-ages cartooning.
And I really, really thought it was a great first issue. So
okay.
I definitely think people should check it out.
What else is on your list?
Lots of DC, so let's go through it quick. We've got the Rebirth special for Supergirl from... Steve Orlando and
formerly the Midnighter writing.
Yes, and quite enjoyed it. It's basically taking a lot of from what Supergirl television show that worked and mapping it into the new Rebirth universe. Then I've got Green Arrow number 5, which kind of seals up the first story arc in a lot of ways.
Okay.
And ties a nice little bow and gets the band back together, which I think it did everything it needed to do, and it was same with the artwork.
I think also real notable is that that Neil Adams cover is my favorite cover he's done. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's Bill Sienkiewicz's signature below his, so I think he might have inked it. But it's a great, at least of the two covers available, Ollie Queen and Black Canary, a couple shot.
Exactly. Then the fifth issue of Batman, which ties up the first story arc. It's very interesting. It leaves Batman in a kind of precarious situation in a lot of ways. So I'm curious to see what Tom King has in store for us. Then the first issue of Suicide Squad, which sees the team, which is basically the movie team, be sent into space to go tackle a new mission.
Killer Croc barfs in his helmet.
He does barf in his helmet.
I just thought people should know. I'm just jumping in.
Yeah, the fifth issue of Superman, which is the penultimate of the story arc that Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason are doing, Superman continues to fight Eradicator.
Sure.
then, of course, the third issue of Nightwing, which I didn't get a chance to read, but it guest stars Batgirl, I know. Then I've got the fourth issue of Scooby Apocalypse, which just continues to be a lot of fun.
I haven't read that yet, but I've enjoyed every issue previous to this. So.
Yeah, I mean... Keith Giffen and James DeMatteis are just kind of killing it for me on this.
Yep.
Then I've got the 12th issue of Uncanny Avengers, which is sort of the finale of the Avengers versus Ultron for the whatever time. And then the 8th issue of I Hate Fairyland, which, again, made me laugh uncontrollably.
Scree!
Dave?
I believe everything has been covered, but I wanted to mention one collection that's hitting this week. My personal favorite run on Wonder Woman from mid to late 80s through to like probably early mid 90s. This is Wonder Woman by George Perez, Volume 1. big old monster trade that I assume probably collects about the equivalent of two what would have been two volumes previously. As I'm flipping through this, I really feel this is George Perez's best art. At, you know, a high point, I would say, even over his Teen Titans stuff. This is Wonder Woman on some level, it's like proto-Vertigo because it had Karen Berger editing, and so it had that sort of character thoughtfulness. On another level, I always love the action-adventure stuff in it. It's almost like very influenced by, you know, old stop-motion Ray Harryhausen stuff like Jason and the Argonauts. She's fighting all kinds of Greek monsters from the Medusa to the Minotaur. But they were always coming up with new and interesting ideas, like Zeus tries to seduce her at one point, and she's not having it. And they take that into an interesting and huge direction. And, you know, they're just... Perez, as writer and artist, was always thinking about things differently. So... This is probably the Wonder Woman series I would most recommend to people. I will be curious to see if any of it's dated. I'm sure some of it will be in probably amusing ways, but I can't wait to reread it.
I like the, and this is just a weird aside, I like the cover choice. Because it's not the typical, it's not the first issue of the Wonder
Correct.
Woman.
So they took like issue, it's like 5 or 6 when she was fighting the Medusa, and is just like coiled by all these serpents and vipers.
It's very cool looking.
Well, one of the cool things about the way he did her hair when it like super extends is that there's like all these different types of snakes. Like there's big old giant python looking ones and like tons of little vipers too. As I recall, that actually, I mean, this straight up happens in the issue, and she's like covered with hundreds of bites of poison and stuff. So it was creepy.
That doesn't sound good at all.
No,
it's not.
She lives though. It's okay.
It's not a party.
Oh, spoilers, Dave. all right. I know some people are reluctant to read crossovers, but Civil War II has been doing pretty well for me so far. So there's a bunch of Civil War stuff this week. A lot of my favorite Marvel books are into it. Power Man Iron Fist #7 continues the story that they did last issue where Iron Fist has wound up in prison. Luke Cage is trying to decide what to do about it. There's a ton of different guest stars, like smaller characters. It's a lot of fun. Spider-Woman #10, which is Carol Danvers is Spider-Woman's best friend. So, of course, she's getting dragged into it. All New Wolverine #11, which sees Wolverine facing off with Steve Rogers. Amazing Spider-Man Civil War #3 by Christos Gage and Travel Foreman, which is dealing with one of his old the characters that Dan Slott created. Shock? No. What is his name? Clash. Civil War X-Men #3, which continues to have the X-Men at odds with one another, brings back a familiar face that I was kind of glad to see. Gods of War #3, which is a continuation of the Hercules series we all liked. And then leaving aside the Civil War stuff, we've got Black Widow #6, which sort of wraps up the first story arc, reveals what the dark secret was that put Black Widow on the run, and sets up a very interesting new status quo for her. Has beautiful art by Chris Samnee. Demonic #1, which is a new book from the Skybound imprint, written by Christopher Sabella, who has done a variety of things for, I think, Boom and Black Mask. It's about a cop who may have some sort of a demonic alter ego as like a brutal vigilante. And it's sort of like, I don't know, I want to say Crow-ish. It's like weird urban street violence with demons and that kind of thing that I think some people, the folks who enjoy like Outcast and Walking Dead and that kind of thing will probably really dig this. Black Hammer #2, which is more of that Jeff Lemire sort of weird retired superheroes thing, which I liked so much the first week. New issue of Descender. Issue of Gwenpool, which I just want to mention, has art by local favorite Irene Strakowski, who was here for our All Ages event. And nice to see her getting some Marvel work. It's really nice looking. And then finally, a weird one. I can't tell if this is an old series or a new series, but it's John Ostrander and Tim Truman doing something called Hotspur, which looks like sort of modern day fantasy. It looks like it takes place maybe, I can't tell if it's actually in like a fantasy world or at a Renaissance fair. But
it does look like it might be a reprint. I'm guessing like something from maybe from the first comics when those guys were teaming up a lot.
It looks like that. It is published by Comic Mix, which is sort of the modern first comics.
Yeah.
It reminds me of their Grimjack stuff. But if you like Truman and Ostrander together, and I certainly do, I'm excited to find their stuff I didn't know about that I can read. That about wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until next time...
Yo-jo!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.